systems and staff. This is Amanda Todd, who's our public information officer, who has made many of the arrangements along with the marshal, Jim Journey, who's there, to get the court on the road. You met when you were coming in, Teresa Owens, our deputy court, Jeff Porter, in sound. And some of the people here in what is ordinarily jury box are law clerks to the court. Why don't they all stand? Thank you for coming.
All right.
With that said, I call the first case, 99-0946, Linda M. Salveson versus Douglas County. Mr. Andrews, you have 20 minutes according to our notes. Mr. Prentice, 5 minutes. Mr. Torvenin, you have 30 minutes, and then Mr. Phillips, you have 5 minutes rebuttal. If you added all that up, it's 30 minutes per each side. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Phillips. Seated to my right is John Prentice. We're both of Prentice and Phillips. We represent Douglas County and Wisconsin County Mutual Insurance Corporation, who is the petitioner in these proceedings and was the defendant at the trial court level. Today, I think it's important to note that we are not going to be taking issue with the jury's findings of discrimination or harassment in this case. What we're here to talk about is the bundle of remedies that the trial court awarded pursuant to its equitable powers granted under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And in order to put these issues in perspective, I think it's important to give the court a brief factual background that will basically set the table for the argument here today. The factual background is set forth in detail in both of the parties' briefs, and so I'm not going to belabor the court with detailed factual information and citation to the record unless the court specifically asks me to do so. But first, let me start off with saying that Ms. Salveson was employed as a paramedic with the Douglas County Ambulance Department starting sometime in 1986. She worked there up until 1995. And let me give you some background about what happened in that intervening time period. On December 24th of 1993, I think it's important to this analysis for the court to know that Ms. Salveson sustained a knee injury during the course of her employment. She received workers' compensation benefits as a result of that incident, and she also went on a late duty assignment. In August of 1994, Ms. Salveson had surgery on that left knee. In September of 1994, Ms. Salveson began a light duty assignment following that knee surgery. Then, on December 12 of 1994, Ms. Salveson went back on regular duty. And I think also, for the benefit of the court and for the benefit of everybody here, we should note that the discrimination and the harassment that was alleged in the complaint and brought forth at the jury trial was happening coexistent with the period of Ms. Salveson's employment, and in fact, it was exacerbated during periods of the light duty assignment because of her proximity to her ultimate harasser, that being Mr. Colliard at the ambulance department. But nonetheless, we go back to December of 1994 when Ms. Salveson went back on regular duty with the ambulance department. After she went back on regular duty in December of 1994, she suffered another accident while on the job. She fell on some ice, and she hurt her hip and hurt her back. She went out on light duty again on April 13th of 1995 because of these injuries, and that light duty continued for a period of time. Now, also in April of 1995, it became apparent to Ms. Salveson and her treating physicians that she would not be able to perform the duties of a full-time paramedic, and so she began the process of applying for duty disability benefits under Wisconsin Statute Section 40.65. So she applied for these duty disability benefits beginning in April or May of 1995. Thereafter, in September of 1995, Ms. Salveson was transferred from her light duty assignment with the ambulance department into the Douglas County Register of Deeds office. It was still more or less a light duty assignment. It was not, the Register of Deeds assignment was not related to the ambulance department, but it was another position within the county accommodating her limitations and her physical limitations on her ability to perform her work.
Date?
Pardon me?
Mr. Date.
It was September of 1995, Your Honor. On November 1 of 1995, Ms. Salveson's application for duty disability benefits was finally accepted by the State of Wisconsin Department of Employee Trust Funds. The application was granted, and Ms. Salveson terminated her employment with Douglas County. That was effective once again on November 1 of 1995. During this intervening time period, in the fall of 1995, beginning of 1996, Douglas County was transitioning its ambulance department out of Douglas County and over to a private entity that was going to take over the functions previously performed by the Douglas County Ambulance Department. The actual transfer occurred on January 1, 1996, and that's when Gold Cross, that was the name of the private entity, took over the ambulance functions for Douglas County. Now, in August of 1998, the case finally went to the jury trial, and like I mentioned before, the jury found that there was discrimination in violation of Title VII, and as a result of the jury's findings, the court conducted post-trial motion hearings in order to determine the amount of the equitable relief that Ms. Salveson was entitled to. The trial court determined that Ms. Salveson was entitled to back pay for the period between November 1 of 1995 up until the date of trial. The trial court also determined that Ms. Salveson was entitled to front pay for a period of 1 year from the date of the trial for 365 days. Now, the trial court also took a look at the two issues that we have before the court today related to the cap on damages. The first issue being, when is the number of employees counted for purposes of determining the size of the statutory cap on damages? That's issue number one. And issue number two is front pay, the remedy of front pay, included within that statutory cap on damages? My partner, Mr. Prentice, will be addressing those statutory interpretation arguments later on. What I would like to focus the court's attention on at this time, if I may, are the equitable remedies of back pay and front pay and whether they should have been awarded in this instance.
Counsel, what's the standard of review on the equitable remedy issues with regard to back pay and front pay?
I think it's clear that the standard of review is for erroneous exercise of discretion. It is a matter within the discretion of the trial court, and I think that's clear under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
So how did the court abuse its discretion then?
In this case, we believe that the court abused its discretion because...
Should I say erroneously exercised its discretion?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. The court, we believe, erroneously exercised its discretion in this instance because it failed to apply the proper standard of law to the facts of this case. Namely, can an individual who is receiving duty disability benefits after certifying to the State of Wisconsin Department of Employee Trust Funds that, number one, the employee was injured on the job, number two, the disability from which that employee suffers is likely to be permanent, and number three, that as a result of that disability that they suffered on the job, they are forced to retire from their position. Given those three factors that are in the 40.65 analysis in order to get duty disability benefits, can an individual then turn around and claim back pay, which is designed as an equitable remedy under Title VII to compensate an individual for that individual being away from work because of the unlawful discrimination? And I think what helps put this analysis in focus is if we take a look, first of all, at the duty of mitigation under Title VII.
Mr. Phillips, let me interrupt you. Why doesn't the collateral source rule come into play here? It would appear that it should. Why doesn't it?
I think that there has been in the briefing a little bit of confusion regarding what the collateral source rule is in a Title VII case. The Wisconsin common law collateral source rule is a hard and fast rule that does not leave the trial court with discretion to deduct or not deduct certain benefits from an award. Under the federal rule, under Title VII in employment discrimination cases, regardless of the source of the other benefits, the trial court still maintains the discretion of whether to offset those benefits or not. And I think that in this instance, the trial court has to apply the federal collateral source rule. Otherwise, there would be absolutely no uniformity throughout the country in the application of the Civil Rights Act.
Don't you have it's the Halifax case, 1975, where the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'll just quote, said that back pay is not automatic, it's not mandatory, but it's one that the courts may invoke, and it's at their discretion. And this seems to be a standard when the front pay and back pay must be measured against the purposes of Title VII. So
I think that's a correct recitation of the law. Since that time, there have been other cases talking about the purpose of back pay and the purpose of these equitable remedies authorized under 706G of the Civil Rights Act. And when you look at the purpose of back pay, it's designed to make an aggrieved plaintiff whole for her injuries suffered as a result of the unlawful discrimination. And it also, at the very beginning, courts recognized that it was to serve a deterrent effect. But I think that we're putting too much emphasis, or excuse me, the trial court and certainly the Court of Appeals placed too much emphasis on this deterrent effect, saying, you know, it's not a matter of discretion for the court that you have to award back pay for the deterrent effect, and that's what we take issue with here today.
Counsel, what Justice Wilcox quoted was that it may be invoked. The Court of Appeals framed your position as the county concedes that courts presumptively award back pay whenever employment discrimination occurs. Are you conceding that that's a correct statement of the law? Is the Court of Appeals correct in labeling that as your concession?
Although I probably would not like to do this, I think I have to make that concession, Justice Bradley, because of the precedent set forth in Albert Barley Paper Company versus Moody and some of the cases that have followed that. There is a presumption in favor of back pay. I think that is established in the case law. But I don't think that that presumption cannot be overcome. And I think that the trial court and the Court of Appeals in this case placed an overly undue burden on the defendants here in order to overcome that presumption in favor of back pay. And when we're talking about duty disability benefits, I went through the three-factor analysis under 40.65 of the Wisconsin statutes. But it's further defined in the Wisconsin Administrative Code about what an individual must do in order to qualify for these duty disability benefits. The plaintiff has argued in her brief that there is not a lot of evidence on this issue that was brought out either in the trial or in the post-trial motions in this case. And I don't think that there a lot of evidence is needed in this case because everything is governed by statute. What a claimant must do in order to qualify for duty disability benefits is pretty clearly set out in the statute in the administrative code. For example, in chapter ETF 52.06 of the code, it says that an applicant, not a doctor or anybody else, but an applicant must certify that their employment was terminated because of this disability. In chapter ETF 52.07, the certification that they provide to the department requires a showing that the applicant is medically required to terminate employment. And so we've got these standards set forth in the Administrative Code and Wisconsin statutes, and the crux of our argument is that if an individual is discriminated against, they are entitled to be made whole for the damages caused as a result of the unlawful discrimination. But they are not entitled to a bonus, and they are not entitled to punitive damages as a matter of course. And that seems to be what the trial court and the Court of Appeals did in this case, is it's a punitive concept.
But the Court of Appeals says, and I'm quoting from 109 in your appendix, says the Department of Work, she said that she maintained, trial court found that she would have been capable of working for Gold Cross either as a paramedic instructor or in some other limited capacity would have accommodated her physical limitations. The Department of Workforce Development's determination that Salveson was physically incapable of working in the field as a paramedic is not inconsistent with her position here, that she would have been capable of working in some limited physical capacity. In deference to the presumption in favor of back pay and the trial court's superior position in making equitable determinations, we conclude that the trial court properly exercised its discretion by awarding back pay. Now, if I hear you right, your position can be restated to say that any time you have a duty disability, as in this case, the trial court has no discretion to award back pay.
Well, with all...
Is that your position?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And I think I can summarize that as follows and answer this question as follows. I think that it's an equitable remedy that's up to the discretion of the trial court, and in exercising that discretion, they have to take into consideration all of the various factors that go into the award of back pay. When an applicant certifies that they are disabled for purposes of obtaining duty disability benefits, the applicant in this case, who's a protective occupation participant employee, is saying, I can't be a paramedic anymore, period. That's what the applicant is saying to the Department of Employee Trust Funds. And we're saying that in this circumstance, that when an applicant says that to the Department of Employee Trust Funds, they can't make that representation to the trial court that they could be a paramedic with a different company in a different capacity. Now, we've also taken issue with the trial court's findings of fact with respect to whether Gold Cross would have, in fact, hired Ms. Salveson in this case, because there was no testimony from an individual with the authority to hire at Gold Cross Ambulance during the course of the trial.
That's right, but they did have testimony of somebody who screened applicants and would make recommendations, even if that person didn't have the ultimate hiring ability.
I agree with that, Chief Justice, and I understand that Mr. Stansberry was making recommendations regarding the hiring of individuals, but the testimony also showed that he did not have the ultimate responsibility of hiring anybody, and the testimony also showed that the position that Ms. Salveson claimed she was qualified to obtain at Gold Cross Ambulance didn't exist. Gold Cross Ambulance would have had to create a position which would have been a teaching-only paramedic position in order to hire Ms. Salveson. And I think that it's a leap for the trial court to make that factual connection in saying that she would have obtained employment at Gold Cross just based upon Mr. Stansberry's testimony, when in fact Ms. Salveson has indicated in her application for duty disability benefits that she can't work. She can't be a paramedic. And so when you look at the statutory framework of 40.65, it also has a provision requiring that an applicant for duty disability benefits pay back those benefits in circumstances where they obtain employment.
Counsel, you may very well be right, but I guess that's one of the questions in terms of the truth of everything. But one of the questions I asked from the get-go was, what is the standard of review? Because there is evidence on the other side and inferences on the other side that are contrary to what you are suggesting. And the trial court discussed that in the trial court's opinion and made and weighed the evidence and came to its conclusion. So in the world of absolute truth, if something exists, you may be correct, but are standard of review is erroneous exercise, and there's evidence and reasonable inferences to support the trial court, it seems to me. Tell me where I'm wrong on that.
Well, I don't think you're necessarily wrong about the general proposition that the trial court exercises discretion in this instance, but the case law is replete with examples of how courts reviewing trial court's decisions on these equitable remedy issues have said that that discretion is not unfettered. And we have provided the court in our briefs with numerous cases where courts have said that the trial court is wrong in offsetting duty.
For instance, let me be specific. Dr. Pride, I think, was maybe the vocational expert, or I forget.
I believe it was the plaintiff's psychological expert.
Psychologist said, look, and the testimony was, look, that it is in part because of the psychological disability. The plaintiff's case is that the plaintiff cannot do the kind of physical exercise and requirements required of a paramedic, but the plaintiff could be a nurse, or the plaintiff can work part-time in the Register of Deeds office. The plaintiff can do a myriad of things, but just can't do her old job. And then you throw, I mean, that's one of the things the trial court was weighing. So it perplexes me how the argument, as I understand your argument, is that she could not work, period, because she got duty disability that automatically indicates she's taking the position that she's not capable of any work. But that doesn't seem to be the plaintiff's position. Help me with that, because I have a problem with that.
I think the issue is what is the duty of an employer and what is the remedy of back pay? What is the remedy of back pay designed to do? And it's to compensate the employee for the position that they lost, to put them back in the position post-discrimination that they would have been in had the discrimination never occurred.
And also acts as a deterrent to
the
two things, right?
Correct. And when you look at this, it would be impossible for Douglas County to put her back in the position of paramedic that she had pre-discrimination. And, you know, using the but-for analysis that was cited in Canova versus NLRB and also referred to in Albemarle Paper Company, using that but-for analysis, what would have happened had she not ever been discriminated against? she would have been out on duty disability benefits. And so what is the county's duty with respect to back pay during that period of time when she was obtaining duty disability benefits? And I think that it's an unreasonable windfall to the plaintiff here to claim in one proceeding that she is completely and completely vocationally disabled from continuing in her job as paramedic, and then turn around and say that Douglas County should have to pay her because she wasn't allowed to continue in the position as paramedic. Douglas County had nothing to do with her duty disability benefits except that they were her employer when this happened. And so I think that it's inconsistent for the plaintiff to claim on the one hand that she's disabled and on the other hand claim that she is entitled to back pay under the but-for analysis.
Could I ask you about the plaintiff's position with the Register of Deeds? Was that a short-term position, or could she have gone on forever?
That was an issue that was brought up in the post-trial motions as to the offer of reinstatement on the Register of Deeds position. I think courts have quite clearly stated that a plaintiff is not required to take a position that is of lesser value, so to speak, in order to mitigate. In this instance, I don't think that one can compare the Register of Deeds light duty position to the position of paramedic. And so we are not making the argument that the plaintiff is precluded from these awards because she refused to take the Register of Deeds position. What we're saying is that the plaintiff could no longer continue in employment as a paramedic and could no longer continue in this chosen vocation, and it had nothing to do with the discrimination, contrary to, well, Dr. Pride may disagree, but, excuse me.
You may finish your sentence.
Thank you.
For those of you who cannot see, why don't you just step aside for one moment? There's a red light that is shining, which indicates his time is up. And he stopped in mid-word. Counsel, go ahead.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I have to remember what sentence I was saying. There are two reasons that she didn't continue in her position, according to the plaintiff, the first being the duty disability, the second being the unlawful discrimination. Applying the but-for analysis and putting the plaintiff in the position that she would have been in had the discrimination not occurred, the fact remains that she would have been out on duty disability. And so applying that but-for analysis, the county should not be held responsible in order to compensate the plaintiff when she was out of work for a reason unrelated to the unlawful discrimination.
Could I ask one? Did I misunderstand, or in terms of back pay, that back pay didn't begin during the time that she was employed with the Register of Deeds, did it?
No, it did not. It occurred beginning on November 1st of 1995.
But was that a lower level of pay?
Excuse me, the back pay award?
No, the Register of Deeds position.
I don't know if it was a lower level. There were less hours involved because she was working 56 hours per week in the ambulance department and 40 per week with the Register of Deeds, and so there was some reduction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Prentice.
Good morning. The issue I'd like to discuss, first of all, is the issue of whether front pay should be included under the cap for damages set forth in Section 1981A(b)(3). First of all, we believe that the answer to this question should be based on the clear statutory language. However, we do need to concede that the overwhelming body of judicial opinion is against us on this point. The overwhelming body of judicial opinion holds that the front pay should not be included under the cap and damages as set forth in Section 1981A. The Sixth Circuit, however, takes a different approach to this. The Sixth Circuit has held that because of the statutory language, and specifically that because the term future pecuniary loss is specifically included in Section 1981B as a remedy that's excluded from the cap, that, and the language is not, our argument is primarily rooted in the language contained in Section 1981AB3, which specifically includes future pecuniary losses. Although Section 1981AB3 also provides that a cap on damages is not to include remedies under Section 706G, Front pay has historically been included in equitable relief under Section 706G. Front pay is not specifically enumerated in 706G. Basically, we feel that the court should look at the actual language. But more importantly, we're not going to dwell on this issue because the Supreme Court of the United States has recently accepted cert in this matter. And I think that the dispute between the circuits will be decided very shortly.
Now, the Seventh Circuit is against you, right?
The Seventh Circuit is against us.
Okay. So has this been brought in the federal court in Wisconsin? They would have followed the federal court of appeals, I assume.
Yes, they would have. There's only one court other than the Sixth Circuit that has taken the position that we are offering the court, quite honestly, and that's a case in Michigan. Federal District Court. But
excuse my ignorance. Is the Michigan in the Sixth Circuit?
Yes, it is.
Also, are there any factors, we're looking at the trial court's decision, that the trial court failed to appreciate or consider here that would make this? You're asking us, start out saying this goes against the great weight of cases out there, and you're asking us to adopt the Sixth Circuit. Is there anything that the trial court did that he failed to consider that would give us some peg to hang our hat on if we were to do that?
No, at the time the trial court rendered its verdict and its decision, the Seventh Circuit had not decided this issue. It has since been decided in the Seventh Circuit. However, there is, as I said, disagreement among the circuits. The Supreme Court has accepted cert on this issue and will decide this issue, I assume, rather shortly.
Has it been set for oral argument, or don't you know, counsel?
I don't know. All I know, it was just recently
taken.
But the issue that we think we have a strong case on is the calculating the damages, regards calculating the damages. For purpose of calculating the cap on damages under Section 1981.3, a court is supposed to look at the number of employees that the employer has in the current year, under the statutory language, in the current year or the year preceding. And, of course, we dispute counsel opposite's contention on what constitutes the current year, whether or not we should look to the number of employees at the time that the verdict was rendered or at the time that the discrimination occurred. We believe logic and the purpose behind the cap on damages dictates very strongly that the cap should, or the number of employees should be calculated at the time that the verdict is rendered. Because the purpose of the cap, in our opinion, is basically to give smaller employers less liability and larger employers more liability. It's an ability to pay type of cap. All right, and things, as Salverson points out in her brief, things may change over the course of litigation. An employer may be doing very well at the time that a complaint is filed, and subsequently economic downturn may occur.
Could you sum up your argument?
Well, basically, we once again think sound public policy dictates that the cap should be applied at the time of verdict, because the purpose of the cap, we believe, is to reflect the ability of the pay of the parties. And this is analogous to an IRS offer and compromise. The IRS offers and compromise come at the time that they make the offer and compromise, and not at the time that the alleged tax evasion occurred, but at the time the offer is made because of the party's ability to pay.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Tolvanen.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. May it please the court, counsel, and ladies and gentlemen of the gallery, I'd like to start out by acknowledging a couple of folks. First of all, Linda Salveson, my client, is present here today, and I think that she's to be congratulated for what has been a long and very difficult row to hoe in terms of addressing these things over a period of time, first at Douglas County and then through the court system, and I'm glad that she's here today. I'd also like to acknowledge my parents who are sitting in the jury box, and I thank them for giving me a ride to this oral argument. There are a couple of background facts. I know that the court is familiar with these facts and many of these facts from the briefs, and so I will keep it brief, but it's important to note that what exactly is the backdrop that this case is set against. Linda Salveson was the first and only full-time female paramedic that ever worked at Douglas County Ambulance Department. Counsel is incorrect in suggesting that she began working there in 1986. She actually began working there in 1981 and had a 15-year career with the Douglas County Ambulance Department. She, as a single mother, rose to be a nationally registered paramedic, and simply put, from 1981 through 1995, she was harassed while she did her job as an emergency medical technician by her supervisor, Richard Colliard, in quite frankly, what could only be considered the most vile and degrading ways that are imaginable, not only for a woman, but for a man, including the names that are so vile that they are not worthy of repetition in present company. Four women testified during Linda's case. Two of them were under subpoena as adverse county witnesses. One of them was a harassment coordinator who conducted the investigation. All of them were brought to tears in recounting what type of behavior they had been subjected to in interacting with Richard Colliard. And this, in fact, is the backdrop of this case. Many
of had a jury verdict in your favor.
That's correct.
Okay. So, and sexual harassment is not the issue. Everybody concedes there is sexual harassment here. You have to, because that part of the verdict is not appealed from, right?
Correct, Judge, Chief Justice Abramson, and I will move on. It is a case of ironies, and there are several things that do need to be mentioned about the facts before moving to the applicable law. One that I think is most ironic from hearing oral argument today is that we talk about the whole reason that we're here on the defense's dime is because they're claiming that she suffered an injury that prevented her from working as a field paramedic. This was not something that was addressed at trial, but what is most ironic about their position is the very injury that they are claiming should be the focal point of the court's discussion was an injury that was occurred in Christmas of 1993 because Richard Colliard forced Linda Salveson on Christmas Eve when he brought in his own personal lawn tractor. This is in the facts of the brief, but brought in his own personal lawn tractor and insisted that she perform work on it, allowed the trailer upon which his personal lawn tractor was sitting to tip and crushed her knee. So it's rather ironic that we are here today to talk about a career-ending injury and whether that should result in an offset, when in fact the very injury that ended her career as a field paramedic and destroyed her leg was one that was perpetrated as part of a series of abuse by Mr. Colliard. The facts, that's a very pertinent fact. What is also pertinent to this analysis is that there was testimony at the trial that there was a teaching paramedic situation which was set up at Gold Cross. That was something that was different from what had occurred at Douglas County Ambulance Department, which only had field paramedics. Gold Cross Ambulance had a teaching department, and in fact, in the submission that I presented to the court as part of my appendix, they have a separate office for that. They have a separate telephone line. It is a community outreach program. Mark Stansbury, who is the gentleman who is in charge of the hiring recommendations at that shop, indicated that he knew Linda and that he would have recommended her for hire.
There was not such a position or department when the county ran the paramedics operation?
That is correct.
And that's a distinction that's important to the legal issue here?
I think that it's an important distinction because if Linda Salveson had somehow brought the proposition forward that she couldn't perform any field paramedic capacity at Douglas County, when in fact Douglas County had a teaching department, then perhaps she would be in some way inconsistent. Here, Douglas County only had field paramedics. She never indicated, if we look at 40.65, I think that the analysis that's presented is in some ways an incorrect reading of the law, because when we look at what is required to be proven under 40.65, whoever submits the disability application, and there are some factual disputes about that, but it need only cause the employee to retire from his or her job. Linda's job as a field paramedic at Douglas County, she was required to retire from. She's not here today to tell you that she can be a field paramedic. And so there is nothing inconsistent about her position. She couldn't do the field paramedic work at the time that it was submitted. And incidentally, it's submitted not by her, but by doctors that are proposed by the county and by the county itself.
So that's in support of the Court of Appeals decision on that point that I read?
I believe so. And I think that the portion that Chief Justice Abrahamson read at page 109 is actually dispositive of the issues because it narrows the focus very pointedly to precisely what I'm talking about. I think that it's also important for the court to recognize that what the facts are before moving into the substantive analysis and what the facts show. What is equally important here is what the facts do not show. The entirety of what was presented to the trial court on the disability procedure that is now the focal point of the defensive case and the estoppel issue and the offset issue is set forth on page 166 of their appendix in 11 lines of transcript. Three questions by opposing counsel at trial merely meant to close out what happened after that to move on to the next point. After the fact, counsel has struggled to remanufacture its case, and so at the disability procedure, if we were here to talk about that, it seems to me that it certainly would have been helpful to ask Linda, what in fact did you tell the disability procedure board? Was it about your knee? Was it about your back? Was it about, there's no questions about the when, the how, there's no documents. It's undisputed. We've been cited to the procedure for section 40.65. Section 40.65 specifically sets out in terms of the procedure and what's required that we need to submit a doctor's opinion from the county, that we need to submit a statement of the case or some analogous language that they use that is in fact the county's statement as to what they believe about Linda's disability and the fact that they believe it to be duty-related. Those documents don't exist in the record. Certainly they would be helpful if we were going to talk about these things, had we been allowed to present these things. They weren't presented at the trial court because they simply weren't a focal point. And so it's important to recognize just as much what is not in the facts as what is in the facts. That is the heart of their case now. And substantively, their arguments are improper. It's important to recognize that, as was pointed out by Justice Bradley, what the standard of review here is for back pay. It is not simply an abuse of discretion in this counsel's opinion, because the abuse of discretion standard, certainly it starts there, but the Albemarle case and Los Angeles versus Manhart and the Gaslighter case, all United States Supreme Court decisions, set out that it is a presumption that can seldom be overcome.
Right, counsel, now I understand that, and I brought up the case you mentioned, but I don't want to jump ahead, but when you look at this and there is a cap, supposedly, I mean, both counsel, opposing counsel argued that, and why would Congress create a cap that would not be tied to the, I'll say, Douglas County, where you have 500 employees or under 500 employees? What is your position exactly on the cap, understanding the rather horrendous background of facts? Aren't you still limited to a cap here? And is that cap when at the time the award is being made?
That the cap, there are public policy reasons for that aside from canons of statutory construction.
Well, there's a law. I mean, there's a statute. I mean, that's the basis of the of when they came down and said, all right, we're going to cap this. We recognize this this type of damage, this liability, but there's a cap. And the cap should be X number of dollars.
That's correct. And it, really what it boils down to is an interpretation of when the current or preceding calendar year is. And to address that, I think I can do it better with the case that I have. It is a case that unfortunately I did not cite in my brief. Time has been a friend to this proceeding in the sense that some of these issues have been addressed. The case is Vance versus Union Planters Corporation, 209 F3rd, 438, a Fifth Circuit decision of 2000. In that case, they addressed precisely this same issue, and interestingly enough, cited to our own Seventh Circuit as the precedent for their decision, and if I may read briefly from that case. Today, we must decide the meaning of current or preceding calendar year. The district court held that it refers to the year of the judgment. It is undisputed that at the time of the judgment, Union Planters had more than 500 employees. Union Planters contends that current year refers to the year that the discriminatory acts took place. We have thus interpreted current year to refer to the year in which the alleged discrimination occurred. See Dumas versus Town of Mount Vernon, 612, F. 2nd, 974, at 979, note 4. The district court, going on with the case, the district court in this case is just about, and I will indicate when I am quoting again, took precisely the position that opposing counsel has taken in this case, which is that the term current calendar year should be interpreted differently in different places in the same statute. In addressing that, the Fifth Circuit said, the district court emphasized that the current year language interpreted in Dumas was a different part of Title VII and stated that no court has interpreted the current year language of Section 1981 AB3, precisely the position taken by counsel here. Quoting again, the latter assertion is incorrect. In Hennessy versus Penrill Datacom Networks, Inc., 69 F3rd, 1344, 1348, and again at 1354, Seventh Circuit, 1995, the court limited the damages assessed against a defendant based upon the number of employees working for it at the time of the discriminatory firing. The district court's interpretation of current year was rejected also in Komorowski versus Town Line Mini Mart and Restaurant, 162 F3rd, 962 at 965, Seventh Circuit, 1998. And then addressing Justice Wilcox's policy arguments, the court did in fact address that by saying, there is no reason to define current year to mean one thing in one part of Title VII and something else in another. Sound public policy analysis supports this reading of the statute. The best reason to use the year of the occurrence is that any other interpretation allows the parties to engage in gamesmanship by structuring companies or timing the progress of lawsuits to minimize gain, maximize gain, or to minimize loss.
Counsel, what pages are you reading from?
I am reading from that decision at page 446. And it's important that I cited in my brief to the Seventh Circuit, which had procedurally been following precisely the plaintiff's argument in this case, but in fact had not formally addressed the issues. The Fifth Circuit presents the synopsis and in fact adopted precisely the analysis that I utilized in the brief and cites to our own Seventh Circuit for the premise.
Thank you, counsel. I want to go back to back pay and front pay and erroneous exercise of discretion and say, talk about the equities of all this. Your client is forced out of the job by both discrimination and disability. Client is recovering disability income through workers' comp. What is fair about saying, now we ought to give her her back pay, which is the pay that she would have earned had she been able to remain there because of without discrimination, and yet not talk about mitigation of damages and decrease the amount of back pay by the amount she has recovered? Just seems fair. I mean, she ought to get her back pay, but she ought not to get maybe more than her back pay. I mean, that's really the argument that Douglas County is making when you cut through all the legalese, right? She could have made X thousand dollars on the job. She's making Y thousand now. Why shouldn't she get X minus Y?
I think that that's appropriate characterization of what their position is, Chief Justice, and what we're talking about is an issue of offset. They've presented two issues, one of which is an issue of offset. The other is perhaps a little bit earlier, which is the issue of whether they should just be a stopped period. Addressing those in sequence, and I promise to directly move to the offset issue, but relative to the issue of whether, first of all, these are very similar issues, whether there's an offset or whether a person should be estopped. On the estoppel issue, that issue has been squarely addressed also by our own Supreme Court in Cleveland versus Policy Management Systems Corporation, 526 United States 795, which is a 1999 decision that I apologize to the court for not having included in my brief, quite frankly. That decision on the estoppel issue addressed a situation precisely, actually, a severe disability than what was taking place here, and the court was being asked to address whether there was, in fact, any inconsistency. The court presented the facts very briefly, thusly, after losing her job, Cleveland, the plaintiff, sought and obtained Social Security disability benefits, claiming that she was unable to work due to her disability. The week before the award, she filed suit under the Americans Disabilities Act, contending that her former employer, the respondent, had discriminated against her. The district court granted summary judgment on the basis that there was some sort of estoppel, addressing precisely the position that's presented by counsel here, that there is in some fashion an inconsistent position. The court stated that the nature of that inconsistency by saying the case before us concerns plaintiffs who both applied for and received Social Security disability benefits. It requires us to review a court of appeals decision upholding the grant of summary judgment on the ground that plaintiff's representation to the Social Security that she was totally disabled created a rebuttable presumption sufficient to judicially estop her later representation that she could not perform the essential functions of her job. The Court of Appeals thought, in essence, that claims under both acts would incorporate two directly conflicting propositions, namely, I am too disabled to work, and that I am not too disabled to work. The court went on, it's important to recognize that in the context of Social Security disability, they are representing not only, as the court noted, that a person is disabled from a particular job, as we have in Linda's case. They are not only unable to do their previous work, but cannot, considering her age, education, and work experience, engage in any other kind of substantial gainful work which exists in the national economy. So here we had a plaintiff that was saying, I can't do a job, any job, anywhere, anytime, because of my disability, and then later on presented a plaintiff's position that I was discriminated against and I should have had my job because I was able to do the job. And the court found that this was, in fact, not an inherent conflict at all. The court indicated that there are too many situations in which these types of claims can comfortably exist side by side, noting that the plaintiff's contention did not involve directly conflicting statements about purely factual matters, such as the light was red/green, or I can/cannot raise my arm above my head. A representation of total disability differs from a purely factual statement in that it often implies a context-related legal conclusion, namely, that I am disabled for purposes of the Social Security Act. So here we have a case where a person it's a much more severe allegation, or it's much more obvious an apparent conflict in the Cleveland case than what we have here, because here we have 40.65, where Linda is simply saying, I'm not able to do my job as a field paramedic, and the court found ample evidence to suggest that there was, in fact, the possibility of other jobs out there that would accommodate her. It's also important to note that although the focal point of this case has been that of a harassment scenario, liability was found in this case by a jury not only on the basis of Linda's harassment, but also on the basis of her disability, where the jury found that she was discriminated against because they refused to provide her with an accommodation. And so I believe that case is dispositive of the issue of estoppel. Turning to the issue of the offset, which was more directly the Chief Justice's question, the collateral source rule in the state of Wisconsin is a dispositive rule. It's, again, rather ironic, I think, that in addressing the front pay, or whether front pay is covered under the damages cap, you will see in counsel's brief at page 32 that they say, this court should completely ignore the federal law because this isn't a federal case. This is a state of Wisconsin case, and we have to follow Wisconsin law. You should ignore the Seventh Circuit's precedent on the front pay issue. Yet, when we come to the collateral source rule and its application, as far as I understand it, the collateral source rule should apply. This is there. They are indicating now we should ignore Wisconsin's rules and instead look to some sort of a sketchy, amoebic federal collateral source rule and apply that. They're presenting inconsistent positions. Either Wisconsin law applies or it doesn't. I would suggest that Wisconsin law does apply, and Wisconsin follows the collateral source rule.
Which is?
The collateral source rule is set forth, the actual definition is set forth at some length in the briefing, but basically what it stands for is a public policy in the state of Wisconsin that is between, when there are monies that are coming into an injured plaintiff from a third party, that the plaintiff is far more deserving to receive that rather than giving what the Court of Appeals referred to as a discrimination bonus to the wrongdoing party simply because the plaintiff saw fit to take means to protect herself by receiving monies from other sources. It's important to recognize that in Wisconsin, it's important to recognize that even if we were to apply the federal, some sort of federal collateral rule or follow some federal proceeding, this is a state of Wisconsin case. The collateral source rule is the substantive law in the state of Wisconsin. Whether we follow the state court laws or whether it is if you folks were federal judiciary sitting on this case, you would be required to apply the substantive law of the state of Wisconsin.
What are they doing in other federal cases or other state court cases with this federal law?
There are, I have in my ancillary materials a litany of cases, several pages of small print where they have followed the collateral source rule. One that I think is particularly pointed on the issue that sets forth the good policy issues is a case that's referred to as Arneson versus Callahan, 128 F3rd 1243. And in that case, the court reading Title VII back pay remedy, this is from page 1247, is limited by 42 U.S.C. 2000E5G, which provides interim earnings by the person or persons discriminated against shall operate to reduce the back pay thus otherwise allowable. This provision prevents employment discrimination victims from recovering twice for the same injury. In this case, the Social Security Administration argues that Arneson's disability benefits, precisely what we have here, constitute interim earnings. The common law collateral source rule holds the defendant's liability shall not be reduced merely because plaintiff's net damages are reduced by payments received from others. And it's citing to Gullett-Ginn, a Supreme Court case, 340 U.S. at 364. In Gullett-Ginn, the court applied the collateral source rule to uphold the National Labor Relations Board's refusal to deduct employment benefits from an employee's NLRA back pay award for unlawful discharge.
The counsel, I haven't read all those cases that you cited in your laundry list, not even close to it, I guess, but I note that at the appendix 163 and 164 of opposing counsel's appendix, that sets forth the trial court's decision on this issue, offset issue, which is controlled by the collateral source issue. And the trial court relied in large part on the O'Grady case. And this is the point of my question. At the bottom of 163, the trial court, in relying on the O'Grady case, said the court in O'Grady emphasized the growing reluctance of the federal courts to permit judges from deducting benefits from back pay awards. My question to you, in that laundry list of cases that you cited, some of which are after the O'Grady case, Seventh Circuit, 1988, is that still the trend, as the trial court said here, the growing reluctance of federal courts to permit this kind of offset?
That is my understanding of the trend. I don't believe that there are any cases that I'm aware of. The only case, it is a fact that it is discretionary in a federal proceeding how to proceed.
Let me just be accurate, be complete. The trend is, especially, that continues on page 164, where a plaintiff has paid for the benefits during his or her employment. And that's what the trial court apparently hangs its decision on, that indeed there was negotiation for this duty disability. They gave up some other gross pay and other benefits to get this duty disability.
That is correct, and that's a very important point. It goes to, in fact, whether this was a collateral source. It's important to recognize that Linda Salveson, in fact, paid for, out of pocket, part of the pension that was there. It's admitted, as is submitted in the citation that was included in the brief. Secondly, this was something that was negotiated for which Linda Salveson and her co-workers, they had actually earned it in the sense that it was in lieu of pay. They actually took pay cuts in order to be protective services employees. And so this is something where it is collateral. It's something that's paid for with sweat and blood, and in this case, pay, out of both out of pocket and in lieu of basically in lieu of actual pay that would have come in essence, an insurance policy that's purchased. And so this is precisely the type of thing that's covered by the collateral source rule. Not only that, but the courts are uniform in presenting that if it comes from a different source and is meant for a different purpose, that's just a further factor in the fact that something is indeed collateral. And here, when we look to the source of the public employee trust fund disability benefits under section 40.01 of the Wisconsin statutes, we find that the source is not at all like those sources or those reasons that are listed for back pay, as that is set forth by the Supreme Court decisions that have been cited here today. So there isn't, as far as I'm aware, there isn't anything that can be cited to suggest that this source is not collateral. They have indicated that it was somehow paid for by Douglas County, and that is simply not true. That's the same premise that was proffered by them when the trial court made the decision that we're looking at here, and it was a very thorough exercise of discretion. They continue to proffer the same argument, looking at the same proofs, and they're asking this court to step into the shoes of the trial court and second guess what the trial court did there when the trial court had the opportunity to look at all that evidence.
Could I ask you a question, Mr.
Yes.
Tormanen? Was the plaintiff discriminated against in 1995?
Yes.
In 1994?
Yes.
In either of those years, did Douglas County have 500 employees?
In either of those years, I do not believe that. I honestly can't recall the question. I believe that it is set forth that a review would support that the number of employees is set
on
forth.
On page 43 of your brief, it is undisputed that Douglas County had in excess of 500 employees in every year through 1993. Now, it seems to me your argument is a very compelling one. If through the entire period of discrimination, Douglas County had had more than 500 employees, it just seems fair. But How far back in time? Suppose it was 1983 that they had 500 employees. Would you be making the same argument then?
I would, Your Honor, in the event that Douglas County did not, when provided with the knowledge that there was discrimination, did not address the discrimination. This is a situation which is routinely set out in Title VII cases, and it's referred to by federal courts as the continuing violation doctrine. The continuing violation doctrine, in essence, sets out that when a person is performing a continuing or an ongoing violation, that any year in which the discrimination occurs, and in fact it does not end and there's no break in the pattern, it allows evidentially a person to bring forward all of the prior years to the last such year of discrimination. And so in this case, that was would have been up through 1995 and also would have encompassed all of the years that Linda worked at Douglas County Ambulance.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you. I would like to address a couple of points on rebuttal here as we close this argument. First of all, I apologize, but we have not reviewed the precedent that counsel has provided to the court today, namely the Fifth Circuit case or the Arneson Callahan case or the other cases that counsel has cited. Should the court require or request additional argument on that, we would be happy to supplement this argument by letter brief to the court within the next week, and I'll leave that to the court's choosing. Nonetheless, I think that it's important to point out the difference between a Social Security disability and Americans with Disabilities Act case in this case. The difference being that courts have recognized, and in fact the Supreme Court accepted cert on this issue, and I don't have the cite for you, unfortunately, here today, but you know, when you're talking about Social Security disability and an employer's requirements under the Americans with Disabilities Act, you're talking about the requirement of reasonable accommodation to accommodate a person's disability. And what the courts have struggled with is if a person claims total disability under the Social Security rules, are they precluded from claiming that they could work with reasonable accommodation under the ADA? That's not at issue here. What we have here is a mechanism under 40.65 where the individual certifies that they are precluded from continuing to work in their chosen profession, that being a protective occupation participant status profession. And once they're precluded from doing that, they're entitled to duty disability benefits. If, for whatever reason, they receive offsetting income while receiving those duty disability benefits, they are required to pay a portion of those benefits back. And what counsel here has ignored is the precedent from the Third Circuit, which is explicitly referred to in the EEOC versus O'Grady decision, and it is set forth in our brief, that being the Dixon case. And what the Third Circuit has said is, generally, you do not offset for disability pensions in situations like this unless it would require a separate proceeding on the part of the state in order to recoup the funds. In the interest of saving taxpayer money and resources, we aren't going to make the state go through a separate proceeding to recoup those funds. We're going to offset them on the front end. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. I don't know if Ms. Salveson has done this or not. That's up to her, between her and the Department of Employee Trust Funds, but she would have to report this back pay income to the Department of Employee Trust Funds and offset that against the duty disability benefits. And so she would have to pay those back anyways. And so that we're claiming, why should the state be forced to go through two separate proceedings in this instance when we can just offset it in this case and move forward?
How do we know how much to offset, counsel?
It's set forth in 40.65 under subsection 5.
No special calculations needed?
Well, it talks about in two different sections. The first section being if you receive offsetting income from the employer under which you were working when you obtained the disability. And that's 100% of the earnings that you receive from that employer. And I don't know what the Department of Employee Trust Funds has in terms of rules on this specific issue, but I would think that a back pay award from Douglas County would be earnings from the employer under which Ms. Salveson received the disability. The second provision is a sliding scale analysis if Ms. Salveson were to obtain employment with another entity other than Douglas County. And that sliding scale analysis applies different percentages depending upon how much money she earns with that other employer. I think it's also important to point out here the relationship between Douglas County and Gold Cross. I think that it was pointed out earlier in argument here today that Douglas County did not have a teaching-only position. And so if Douglas County would have closed its ambulance department, everything would be going forward. And let's say, for example, that Douglas County did not even have an ambulance department anymore. It didn't go anywhere. What is Douglas County's ability to provide Ms. Salveson with employment after the ambulance department closes. Douglas County cannot control a private employer. And I think that speaks also to the front pay issue. If you look at the factors that are set out in Ward versus Tipton County Sheriff's Department, one of the factors is the ability of the employee to obtain comparable employment. Well, I think the duty disability application says that she can obtain comparable employment to that which she enjoyed with the Douglas County Ambulance Department. And in addition, Douglas County did not even run an ambulance department following January 1 of 1996. And so I think those are factors that need to go into this analysis. And while it is a discretionary analysis on the part of a trial court, that discretion is not unfettered. The trial court has to take into consideration all these different factors, which the trial court in this case, quite frankly, failed to consider.
I think that was my question. I'd asked the other counsel that you say that he did not, the judge did not include those factors.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would agree with that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both to Mr. Phillips and Mr. Prentice, Mr. Torres.